Hello and welcome to Written in Uncertainty, an Elder Scrolls podcast sat firmly in the grey maybe of Tamriel, and proud member of the Robots Radio podcast network. My name is Arimithius, and today we're looking into what is supposedly the oldest culture on Tamriel, which stretches back into the Merithic era, if not before, and indeed celebrates the Merithic era as one of the highest points of creation. Today we're asking, what is Ultmeri religion all about? Before we get into that, though, I just wanted to go through a few announcements on the network side of things. There is a new podcast on the Robots Radio Network, the True Vault Escapades podcast, which is a Fallout audio drama. So if you like the Fallout universe and want to get some more stories of the characters behind that and hear them all played out, go check them out. I know the guys involved. They do a fantastic job on production, and I'm sure they do a fantastic job with this. And also, there is the Robots Rocket Club. If you are thinking of launching a podcast and don't know quite where to start or want a hand to get it out there and get it marketed properly, Robots is offering a service for that. And I think there is one slot left on the current crop of Robots Rocket Club podcasts. So if you feel like you need a hand with that, check that out. There will be a link in the podcast description. And also, I know there's been sales on from various corners at the moment for, I think it's been the Lunar New Year or something, but if you've missed out on that and you want to get some savings on your games anyway, check out one of the sponsors for the Robots Radio Network, Green Man Games. There is a referral link in the description which will get you a discount on the ticket price of anything you buy through Green Man Games. So check that out. And I also wanted to thank three new patrons who I've had recently. I've had Nathan, Mackenzie, and Kyle become patrons of this podcast. Thank you so much, guys. I'm absolutely blown away that you think this is worth supporting. And just thank you so much from the bottom of my heart that you can help me carry this on. And I hope that you're enjoying the access to the notes that I've been making as I develop this podcast. If the rest of you want to get access to the notes that I make, as well as early access to the podcast when they're recorded and before they launch, go to patreon.com/writteninuncertainty and sign up for that. I have recently shifted to a per episode monetization, as I said last time, because I'm moving to a when they're ready release model for episodes. I've been trying to publish them every 2 weeks, and that's just not been practical at the moment. So I really want to just get these things out when I feel that they're ready, rather than rushing to get them out to meet a deadline. So you can sign up to contribute per episode that gets released, and if there's nothing released, then you don't pay anything. There are some complications for existing patrons, and if you are an existing patron listening to this, then go over to the Patreon and check out all of the options that are there. You need to migrate to another tier that I've made, otherwise you'll end up paying the same amount as you did per month per episode. So please go and check that out and make sure that you're migrated over to the new tier. And I also wanted to say thank you to Odderlord. I've been having some conversations with them about the nature of Akatosh and Lorcan and how those two interrelate. Odderlord had a fantastic idea that Lorcan was in essence masquerading as Akatosh after a certain point. I think we settled on the Middle Dawn as about the point where the change happens, but I'm not totally on board with that, because I'd expect there to be some hints somewhere that there was some deception going on as to what Akatosh is, rather than Akatosh just being nuts, which is the consensus we get from a few texts, and as well as possibly having the selectives alter the nature of Akatosh from what they were doing. But thank you so much, Older Lord. It's been a pleasure chatting with you over Discord. And I also had an email from Rob the Balloon Guy that I'm just going to read out in full. Hello, Arimithius. I only recently started listening a few months ago, but I'm almost caught up. I have a question that popped up while listening in the Q&A of March of 2020. I mean, Was it that long ago? Wow. While you were discussing the Dwemer and their version of atheism, I had a thought. I'm not sure there's an answer outright for it. Before they disappeared, what happened to the soul of a Dwemer after death? What happens to the soul of a non-believer, in quotes? I assume Adra or Daedra would love to call dibs on an unclaimed soul. Maybe that was part of their motivation. It's possible their disappearance was a controlled Jonestown event, where they all effectively died, but ensured that their souls were finally free of being claimed by another being. I use the Jonestown reference mainly to draw parallels of an intentional mass suicide based on cultural belief. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Thanks. Well, Rob, I'm not sure that we have a real answer for that, because the only indications that we have beyond they just go to Aetherius somewhere is that the souls of mortals, when they die, they will either go to the Soul Cairn if they've been soul trapped, or to their aligned AE. I've seen somewhere in one of Kirkbride's outer game texts, which implies that if they're inclined a certain way, then they will head to the place that most suits them in the afterlife, which kind of auto assesses where they should be somehow at the point of death. I would assume that something similar goes on with the Dwemer, but we've got very little evidence for that either way. Exactly where a Dwemer would be suited to, Hameas Morum, maybe? I mean, there's knowledge and secrets in that, and the Dwemer were a very knowledge-focused society, but that feels not exactly right either, just because they're so anti-mysticism as such. But I don't know. And you're absolutely right, though, that the Daedra and the Aedra would absolutely love to have all of these unclaimed souls as part of their store of power, so to speak. If we think about souls in terms of lunar currency, they definitely work that way. And from what we've seen from how Molag Bal uses souls in the Plane Meld. So it would absolutely be something that that any particular Etada would want to scoop up, particularly the Daedra. And so I'm not sure that the Dwemer would necessarily care about what happens to their souls after death, unless they were aware of it. We don't really know quite what the nature of the afterlife is, unless spirits are brought back a bit into the mortal realm. But if it didn't really matter too much about what happened to the soul after death, then I don't think the Dwemer would be too fussed. But if they were conscious, then you're right, there could be this final, well, screw you, if you're going to ultimately get what I am, then no one's going to get it idea. That does sound kind of plausible, but again, it's not something we have a huge amount of evidence for from what we know of the Dwemer's motivations, the status of their souls, apart from possibly being mashed together to make a new god. Didn't really enter into the equation as far as I can tell. But thank you ever so much for your thoughts, Rob. It was an angle that I really hadn't considered before, so thank you for the email. And if any of you listening wants to drop an email, drop a line to writteninuncertaintypodcast@gmail.com, and I will try and get back to you on the emails when I can, and also potentially talk about it on the show. And just some other bits and pieces of show admin. I've been recently on the Scroll Talk podcast, that is a show that both has guests on to talk and does information about the various goings-on of the Elder Scrolls Online. We talked about the potential lore implications and developments of the Gates of Oblivion event. It was an absolutely fantastic chat that I had with Noble and Goodstash on that podcast, and hopefully introducing Noble to various bits of the lore in ways that got him some decent answers. And I will also, I don't know exactly when it's going to hit relative to when this episode comes out, but I will also be discussing Almalexia with Firewriter of the Pixel People podcast. The Pixel People podcast is one of the Robots Radio Rocket Academy shows, and it basically, each episode discusses a particular NPC and all the various angles to do with that in that NPC, they've had some fascinating discussions about AI off the back of a character on the Outer Worlds and that sort of thing. So I'm going to be discussing Almalexia on that show pretty soon. I don't know, again, when it's going to launch relative to when this episode comes out, but keep an ear to the ground for that Pixel People podcast. And I also, before we get to the episode, have two reviews I want to say thank you for on iTunes from Spooky Spoose. It was literally just awesome. Great stuff. Please keep it up. Thank you, Spooky Spoose. I'm really glad that you're enjoying my content, and I absolutely plan to keep it up for as long as I can. And I'm sorry that life's been chaotic enough that I haven't been able to get these things out as regularly as I would like to. And from the Ninth Divine, fantastic. First of all, thank you. It's absolutely brilliant that we've got one of the Elder Scrolls gods listening to this show. That's frankly, I'm flattered. They say, fantastic work. Been a huge fan of the games and world since I was a youth. You and all you work with do incredible work. Bringing this world so much more depth than it truly deserves. Keep up the hard work and may your feet know warmer sands. Well, thank you very much, Ninth Divine. I am shocked to discover that Talos is in fact Khajiit. You heard it here first, folks. Now I think we should get to Ultmeri worship practices. To start off with, I think I should say my usual disclaimer here that this is my interpretation of Ultmeri worship. I have tried to draw from several different sources and several different discussions that I found, but I may have missed something and I'm quite opinionated anyway. So you may have different ideas. If you do, I would absolutely love to hear them. Please drop me a line at writteninuncertaintypodcast@gmail.com. And if you want to check all of the sources that I'm referencing here, the transcript for this episode will be at writteninuncertainty.com/podcast/ultma-religion. And so you can check out all of the things I'm quoting there, see where I'm getting my ideas from in a broader context and that sort of thing. I want to start off by looking at Moorish religion a bit more broadly, looking at Old Moorish religion rather than just Ultmer religion, just so that you get an idea of where the ancient and modern Old Moorish religions come from. And Old Moorish religion is the religion of the Old Moor who settled Somerset and then became the Ultma, presumably. And I also want to use Old Moorish religion as a sort of a catch-all term to talk about the kind of splinters off from the Old Moorish branches and traditions. So I think I'd probably better start off with reasons as to why I'm going quite so broadly in my definition. And that's because most Moorish religions treat themselves as being descendants from the gods, while, at least according to the stories we hear from the monomyth, men consider that they've been created by the gods. I personally think the actual reality of that is a little off, given the accounts that we have of the old and wandering El Nefay in the Anuad, where both sides seem to be descended in some way from the Etada. But I don't want to get too much into the weeds of that here. I did talk about that a bit more in my podcast on the difference between men and Moor. So if you want to hear a bit more about that, check that particular episode out. But that idea of descent and the relation that is part of the Old Moor understanding of themselves and their gods informs a lot about what they do. So you'll hear a lot about the importance of family for the Ultma, and the idea of being descended from the gods means that the worship and rituals that come from that have that same level of significance to the Ultma. And it also means that because of all the various strands of the Ultima consider themselves to be descendants of the gods, that means that ancestor worship is the effective default setting for most Ultmeri religion. We do have various offshoots of that, like the Kymeri religion that worshipped the Daedra as ancestors, while the Bosma worship Ifri, who the Ultmer equate with Jeffrey, who may or may not have sung Ulmer into being, if you believe the tale that's presented in The Ooze, a fable. And then there's the Sijix, which we'll get into a bit more detail about later. The ideas of ancestor worship all stem from the religions practiced on Ultmeris itself, from what we can tell. We don't have any primary texts on what was actually going on Ultmeris, so we have to go from some other sources. The most obvious example of this, or the clearest example, as is frustratingly enough often the case, is the Pocket Guide to the Empire, in this case the 3rd edition, which says this, quote, "Early Ultmer society was agricultural and politically egalitarian. A system of ancestor worship had been exported wholesale from Ultmeris, and it brought with it a communal spirit that served the early settlers of Somerset well. When the Ultmer came together as a people to create the Crystal Tower, it was not as a monument to any king or god, but rather to the spirit of the elven people, living and dead." Now, this is freewheeling ancestor worship, so to speak. It's just worship anyone who has gone before, and possibly even those who are still currently around. It's just, yes, let's pat ourselves on the back and look at this wonderful society that we've created. The point about the Crystal Tower is interesting, because it indicates that the Crystal Tower is essentially a religious monument to ancestor worship, and it also sounds quite generic. There are no specifics here, no particular ancestors, but all Ultmer are the focus of the Crystal Tower there. I would caution that this is the Pocket Guide, and so is written from a pro-Cyrodiilic perspective, and is removed from anyone who has a particular stake in the Crystal Tower, and so is likely to be a little different from the Ultmer or Ultmer's own perspective on what they were actually doing. However, we have this from the book The Old Ways, which was written by a Sijic. In particular, it says this, quote, "What, after all, is the origin of these spiritual forces that move the invisible strings of Mundus? Any neophyte of Arteum knows that the spirits are our ancestors, and that, while living, they too were bewildered by the spirits of their ancestors, and so on to the original Arcarii. The Daedra and gods the common people turn to are no more than the spirits of superior men and women whose power and passion granted them great influence in the Phantom World." Now, this is similar to the position of the Pocket Guide, but with the differences that the ancestors are removed from the first order of things worshipped, but it instead talks about spiritual forces that move the strings. This isn't entirely ancestor worship in the polytheistic sense, if I can put it that way, but it feels more animistic. That is, the world itself is imbued with a spiritual presence that makes it go, and that presence is revered in itself. It's also slightly distinct from the world, otherwise that would be pantheism, just to give you a bit of clarity there. There is a possible distinction between these and the gods, but if we go with the monomyth, we know that the Sijics have a history of making their beliefs palatable to others, so it's quite possible that the text is making it closer to the presumed reader's expectations in talking about gods at all, rather than the Sijics having a definite category of gods and other sacred spirits. And the way that this differs from Ultmeri religion in general is portrayed in the Pocket Guide as the evolution of some social trends that were going on in Somerset. They say it like this, quote, "The religion of the people also changed because of this change in society. No longer did the Ultmer worship their own ancestors, but the ancestors of their betters. Aureol, Trinimac, Cyrobane, and Finaster are among the many ancestor spirits who became gods. A group of elders rebelled against this trend, calling themselves the Sijics, the keepers of the old ways of Ultmeris." Now, this makes the Sidgwick part of what was possibly a wider religious schism in Somerset, which I personally think includes the Cymer and the Direnni as well. We don't know when the Sidgwick split from Somerset, and the Book Vex teaching claims that Veloth wasn't part of the Sidgwicks, but they feel like they're possibly both factions that evolved as part of the same reaction against the stratification and reform of religion on Old Meres. And I've also argued before that the Direnni moving to High Rock may well have been part of that same movement, but there's probably less evidence for that. And it doesn't really help that we don't have any concrete dates for when these exodus happened. The Velothi are the only ones that we have any sort of date for, which is the Middle Merithic era, and that's just gloriously vague. It feels to me like these groups are reacting to the same thing, so it must be happening at the same time, but or a similar time anyway, but that is just me. I could be horribly wrong there. The Ultmer who followed the reforms defaulted to the worship of what would become the pantheon of the Aedra. Although the text mentions them, it doesn't feel like we should have all of the Ultmeri deities like Saravain and Finasta. We have detailed accounts of some of their mortal actions that happened in response to the Thracian plague in Saravain's case, for example, and that was in the first era. So the portrayal that the Pocket Guide is giving isn't accurate to what it would actually have been like at that point, but I suppose it's an indication of the direction that things were moving in. And it's also possible that these people never really ascended at all. We don't really have a whole heap of evidence for that, despite the fact that the Ultmer have several deities who are ascended mortals. We've already talked about Finasta and Tharabane. Auriel is supposedly a god who became a mortal and then became a god again, and maybe Xarxes. All of these people were at one point mortals and then became gods because of their actions. Although of these, we don't have a whole heap of evidence that they did actually achieve their divinity, but they are just revered as gods. Although whether that makes an actual difference is an open question, I guess. I don't know whether being a revered spirit in Aetherius is any different from being a god in Aetherius. We don't have an awful lot of things to go on there. But regardless of the actual method, there are several elves who supposedly reascended, and this is taken as something of a natural consequence of being an elf, or something that is expected of a successful elf, so to speak. Although that's more of an opinion in the fandom than we have an awful lot of hard textual evidence for, at least that I could find at this point. The most direct thing that I have found is a quote from a Khajiit, which explains how Somerset society works. It's a book called Tips for a Khajiit in Somerset, and it says this, quote, "The Thracian plague seems but a faded scar next to the still bleeding cut of the Nahartan flu, but it holds a deep importance to the Mer of Somerset. Bazumi thinks this has much to do with the involvement of their god ancestor Saravain, also known as the Warlock's God, a mage so powerful that he ascended to godhood. Well, is that not the High Elf ideal?" This sort of thing is where people get the idea that the Ultmer are looking to escape Mundus and get back to being gods themselves. That sort of outlook of, well, if I try hard enough, I will ascend again. And there's also the reascension of Auriel that showed the Ultmer the way to do it. Or showed the Ultmer the way to do it, rather. That does seem to kind of be the idea when you look at quotes like this, but I don't think it's the whole story. The quote that I just read from the Khajiit mentions that Saravain preserves the memory of the Thracian plague, and that's possibly the role that these cultural hero gods play in Ultmeri society. With the shift to the ancestors of their betters, Ultmer strive to preserve worthwhile deeds and acts. That's the whole reason for their society preserving everything. To become something worth preserving is possibly the goal here, to be part of the great story and lineage of the Elnafae, which is something close to godhood, because the Elnafae were close to godhood. I think that also explains why the High Elves revere Xarxes in particular. It's his role to be Auriel's scribe, to record history and all that sort of stuff. He becomes the gatekeeper of the lineages of the Ultmer, and perhaps an ultimate judge of who is worthy to be accounted as an ancestor. That, if that's true, that would make him a door to divinity that must be respected and crossed. Or, well, that's the sense that I get. That's an awful lot of my speculation there, but it makes sense to me. The Ultmeri concern for preservation does extend to Mundus, though, despite what several fans may think about the Falmor destroying the world in particular. I've previously questioned why the Ultmer don't have any aesthetic strains to their faith in a previous cast, but I think I found an answer to that one. The book Corruption of the Blood says this, quote, "For millennia, we Ultmer have safeguarded a divine legacy. We are all that remains of old Elnafey. We were entrusted by the Etarda to preserve what they sacrificed so much to create." So, for the Ultmer, their faith encourages a preservation of what was by following the old ways and traditions, because it's something worth preserving and remembering the sacrifice by carrying on what was, rather than innovating and being new and different and that sort of thing. So that explains why there's no asceticism, because you want to enjoy the gifts of what your gods, your family, your ancestors gave up everything to create. There is a little bit of doublethink going on here, because while, to quote the monomyth, the Ultmer see creation as, quote, a painful separation from the divine, once creation is here and working as a relic of the divine, if I can put it that way, it's to be protected. Also the sense that old Elnafey is the thing that needs preserving. The past is sacred, while the future and everything that comes from elsewhere is inherently profane. This makes the repetition of what's come before a sacred act, and perhaps one that has eschatological significance. That is, that if you don't follow all these things and these that you have to do, you will bring about the end of the world. By repeating the acts that emulate those that created Mundus, you help preserve it. So the Ultmer's acts of preservation, which run from their veneration of the first ancestors right through to ensuring that their craftsmanship is to the required standard, have a religious and possibly existential significance. The Ultmer have refined this down to a particular way of being, if some NPCs from the Elder Scrolls Online are to be believed, the Path of Alaxan. The Path of Alaxan is described this way by an NPC called Olnawil, who we meet looking for seashells on a beach. Alaxan is the state of perfection that every High Elf strives for. The path to Alaxan represents the approach we take to achieve that state. Now, that she can achieve this by being an artist rather than achieving some more mystical form of enlightenment, again speaks to the ultimate desire to preserve Mundus as an instrument created by the Aedra. It's not something to move beyond or separate yourself from or that sort of thing, which is a bit more of a Dunmurry standpoint. She also says that the Path of Alaxan requires constant vigilance, which suggests that it also has a kind of mental component. There's no mention of ascending to godhood in that particular conversation, but as she's distracted from everything that she was doing, she possibly wouldn't be in a position to give a full breakdown of the path. But as the Path of Alaxan is something that's followed by most, if not all, Ultmer, she talks about every High Elf striving for it. I mean, not all will, but enough must be in order to make that sort of a claim. I don't expect the Path of Alaxan to actually work all that often. We don't hear of an awful lot of perfected High Elves wandering around reascending, that sort of thing. So there's only a handful of Ultmer who ascended out of the multitude that would be on the Path of Alaxan. And I'm going to get a little conspiratorial here, but unless ascension isn't the point. To keep on the idea of preserving things. The cultural markers for the Ultima that everyone hates, the tight hierarchy, the way of doing things, that things like the Ultima rules of dueling and the proper conflict that get mentioned in the book Common Arms of Valenwood that the Ultima are so keen not to diverge from, are all about being in a particular way, acting in a particular fashion towards the world, and being something close to what the Elnafe were as a culture. And maybe it's the preservation of that culture as a whole that's the goal of the Path of Alaxen. It's not to get individuals up the ladder, but it's to keep the ways of the Elnafe alive. And it also potentially has significance for the whole culture and for individuals. To quote from the Corruption of the Blood again, they say this, quote, "To stray even slightly from the ways of our ancestors will have dire consequences." And it then goes on to talk about the different types of Myr that have soiled themselves in various ways and become different. So this feels like the notion that Michael Kirkbride has said on Reddit that wars in the Dawn era were ideologies given skin, to quote. The divergent ideologies of the various strains of the Ultima are a thing of terror to these types of Ultima. There are a lot of object lessons about what deviation from the path of preserving the Elnafe can do. Every other kind of Myr out there, with the possible exception of the Marimar, were the result of some ideological change, some form of corruption from the old Myr ideal before they became transformed, and it was potentially that change in ideology that brought about that transformation. So there's this very visceral reminder of what happens when you don't toe the line and follow the ways of the Elnafe. So combine this with the long lifespan of the Ultima and the constant reminders of the past that are a part of their culture and their worship of particular gods who did particular good things in the past, and you can almost understand the Ultima need to keep themselves closed off from the rest of Tamriel. If coming into contact with other races has always brought about pain and suffering and change and degradation, why would any interactions in the future, or any interactions that you might personally make, be any different? Some such contact isn't direct contamination, but it's not like ritual contamination that you need to then wash yourself in various ways and be separated from the community and so on, like we see in ancient Judaism. But it's a contamination of thought. If you enjoy the company of men, what happens then if you start to adopt their ways? The remnant of the Elnafe that was in you passes away, is forgotten, and some of that splendor of the past, a little bit of that godhood, slips away into nothingness. And that's the worry for the Ultima, I think. And that also means that the Ultima are likely to think that the past contains all the answers. So I now want to look at what happens when it's clear that the past and traditions don't do that, what Ultima tend to do, and what that means for how they operate in the world. I want to preface this by saying thank you ever so much to Happy B3 for this, because he's got a fantastic essay out there that looks into the world-ending cults of the Ultima and why they fall for Daedra worship so often. If you look at a lot of the quest lines in ESO and in some other games, there's quite often a Daedra worshipping Ultima somewhere in there, and he looks at the reasons as to why and what that means for them as a culture. But go and have a look at that. Have a read of it while you can. It will be in the show notes here, and it will also be in the blog post that goes alongside this podcast. Now, we have several examples of the Ultima taking up Daedra worship, or at least entering into pacts with the Daedra in order to achieve their goals. Happy has pointed out that these goals all seem to involve remaking the world or yourself. None of them are destructive as an end, so it's not that the Thalmor want to tear the world down necessarily, or it's not for any particular individual Ultima Daedra worshipper to be rewarded for their service and so get to rule in hell or anything like that, at least for the most part. But there's this fantastic example when you talk to Earl Lathan in the ESO Somerset expansion about why he joined the Court of Bedlam, which is the cult that supports the plot of Nocturnal, Mephala and Clavicus Vile. He says this, quote, "The court offered me a purpose after my life lost its meaning. Our princes promised to remake the world, turn it into a better place, a paradise. And they were going to elevate the Ultima back to their status as gods. Suffering would come to an end." And then the player character says, "Isn't that what Nocturnal still wants to do?" And then we're back with Earl Lathan again. "Not in the least. Remaking the world to eliminate death and disease is one thing. Destroying everything to turn yourself into a being of infinite power, well, that's something else entirely." So, he doesn't want the world to be thrown away in order to serve his mistress. He very much wants the world to still be there and be a perfect place. And similarly, when Veya, who then became Earl Tondilwen, gives an account of why she joined the court in her private thoughts journal, she says this, quote, "Mother has given me a new name, a new goal. Blood will be spilled, lives will be lost. But in the end, the world itself shall change. No more pain, no more loss. No longer am I daughter of House Redoran. Now I am daughter of Nocturnal. My name is Tondilwen, and I will burn the world so that a better one may rise from the ashes." There are several more examples of this, and Mankar Cameron in The Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion being the most obvious one, because he's after Numantia Liberty, and he creates paradise as a paradise as far as he's concerned. And they all stand in contrast to the standard Ultima review that preservation and cultivation of what's there is needed, rather than revolution and destruction. However, that older belief of preservation is contingent on things going as they should, of the world not going too awry from how it should work and assigning the Ultima their proper place in the world. When the world stops working how any given Ultima thinks it should, they are potentially vulnerable to start following Daedra and start trying to remake the world to work in the proper way, by violence and disregard the older ways of just preserving stuff. This is spelled out in the 3rd edition Pocket Guide to the Empire this way, quote, "For thousands of years, the Ultima have implicitly believed in their superiority to all other races and cultures in Tamriel. For much of this time, they may have been right, but after the incorporation of Somerset into the Empire, doubts began to creep in. With the insularity of the Somerset decisively broken, many Ultima, particularly the young, which among the High Elves is a fairly loose term, began to take a more critical view of the rigid hierarchy of Ultima society and its strict cultural xenophobia. While there had always been a discontent on the fringes of the Ultima society, which was traditionally resolved by exile of the malcontents, for the first time a significant element of Ultima began to agitate for social change." Then there's a paragraph about the benefits of this approach, and then this, quote, "A darker side of this movement, however, is exhibited by a shadowy group who call themselves the Beautiful. Originally a salon for artists with the reasonable philosophy that Somerset must let go of its past in order to move forward, the Beautiful became a revolutionary gang dedicated to the destruction of the greatest monuments of Ultima civilizations. The Crystal Tower was naturally an early target, and fortunately attempts against it have failed, but many other great ancient sculptures and emblems of the past have been vandalized. Lately, the Beautiful have turned their attention to living symbols of the Isle, the royalty of Somerset. The particularly gruesome murder of the daughter of the King of Shimmerine has horrified and outraged the public." So the Beautiful are acting in the same way as the Daedric cults here in a fashion. They have their promised expected heritage denied them because they are under the thumb of the Empire, and so their impulse is to turn on the world that created them and tear it down and rebuild. That the Beautiful are often thought by fans as the beginning of the fourth era of Thalmor should give you a rough idea of how it leads. And this, in my opinion, is where the alt-Murray thought turns almost fascist, in the same way that violent Islamism is fascist. What do I mean by that? Just to unpack it, in a book, The Nature of Fascism, Roger Griffin defines fascism as palingenetic ultranationalism. That is a form of nationalism that relies on palingenesis, or rebirth, to give it a less fanciful term. I don't know quite why that one was used, but that was palingenetic was the word. Fascist movements and most violent Islamist movements and the Fourth Era Thalmor all rely on appealing to a return to some sort of tradition that never really existed, and a reassertion of a violent social and political identity in the face of a world that doesn't work the way they think it should. The reason I say that the tradition never really existed in the case of the Fourth Era Thalmor is because it's not precisely static. While there are things like the standards of craftsmanship and so on that are designed to preserve everything, if you look at the way that the different armors, for example, change from game to game, it's not just a re-rendering to make it more up to date to the latest graphics. It's a complete restyling in some ways, and that means that there is cultural shifting going on, and that it's not quite as perfect a capturing of the stuff of old Elnafay as the Ultima Taps want. But the idea that the Ultima should be at the top of the socio-political food chain was also kind of torn down when they were conquered by Tiber Septim, so that's part of the reason for the ongoing grumbling. But the reaction to that, as well as, just to keep the parallel with Islamism going a bit, to the conquest of the Islamic lands and subjugation of some areas, or at least the willing participation in the global system by places like Saudi Arabia, if I can put it that way, is that the Ultima need to be even more Ultmeri, and that Islamists need to go back to a more fundamental form of Islam. But so that's, they need to be Ultmeri, but different from before. They need to stand united, but different from before. The preservation doesn't become about the preservation of tradition, but the preservation of what supremacy and power they have, and then they wield cultural signifiers in order to justify it. In that way, the Thalmor justified suppression of dissent, and at least that's how the book Rising Threat puts it, that the Thalmor manipulate public opinion to allow them to change Ultima society to how they want it to be and keep them in power. This is only really possible because Ultmeri beliefs did not have the tools to think that they could have been wrong. I mean, most other cultures in Tamriel have a coping mechanism of sorts, if I can put it that way, that allows them to adjust their behaviour or at least have an explanation for why the going will get tough. The Khymer and later the Dunmer and the Nords just expect life to be hard, and they get on with whatever life throws at them, with the Nords particularly enjoying the fight. The Red Guards know that they have to walk in different ways to reach their ideal, and that the creation of the mortal world is a sinful thing, and that it's all going to go horribly wrong unless they do something. The Khajiit tell themselves that Nerni has set her face against them, and life will be harsh. The Bosma have the spinners to tell whatever stories they need in order to carry on being the Bosma in any given situation, and the Bretons have Shior's machinations behind things. The Cyrodiils have any number of different cults, and I'd imagine they can also change focus from one divine to another as they need to explain what's going on. It's, oh, we haven't been paying attention to this particular divine at this point in time, and if we do that, things will get better. It's only the Ultima that have these social expectations just so baked into their culture and their faith that when the world doesn't line up for them the way it should, they just break and turn to Daedra worship. And that's where we're going to end our little meander through the history of Ultmeri religion and Next time, we're going to have the first of our mini-sodes, some of those little topics that I'm not sure will quite produce a full long episode, but still need to be covered. I said a while back I would be covering the Wilder King. I will be starting to produce that, so watch this space for that. The next full episode that we have will look into the religious and cultural history of the Reachmen. There's been a lot more stuff going on for them in ESO, and there's an awful lot that can be talked about with them. So I look forward to delving into that with you guys. And until then, this podcast remains a letter written in uncertainty. You've been listening to Written in Uncertainty, a podcast written and presented by Aramithius and edited and mastered by Dopportunity. The music for this podcast has been kindly provided by Jan Glimbotsky. Check them out on SoundCloud under Songs from the Lost Land, and I'll see you next time.
Ahoy there, ye landlubbers! Avast! My name is Captain Logan, and I'll be your guide out on the Sea of Thieves. If you love the idea of stealing treasure, cutting down cursed skeletons, fighting off krakens, and raiding forts filled to the brim with shinies, then Sea of Thieves is the game for you. Join me each week as I dive into the news and bring back the nuggets of information that any sailor worth their weight in salt would desire. You don't have to be a pirate legend to gain access to my podcast. Just search for Keelhauled, a Sea of Thieves podcast in your podcast app of choice, or head over to robotsradio.net or captainlogan.podbeam.com and get ready to set sail for adventure. Arr.
Hey, I'm Tom.
And I'm Stuart.
And we're from the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast.
We talk about all things connected to D&D lore.
And we're on the Robots Radio Network. So if you're into Dungeons & Dragons or you're into lore, then come check us out. You can find us on any podcatcher, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, wherever you get podcasts.
Roll more dice.
That's the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast.
Hello.
Hi.
Do you like bad movies?
Do you find yourself defending bad movies, saying things like, well, the soundtrack was okay, or the costumes were pretty fun?
From the previous hosts of It's Not That Bad podcast, we bring you Fresh Tomatoes, the movie podcast, from Simone LaRue and Chad Ekovitz.
Every week, we review two movies that did not do well critically, but we say, hey, there are some nice things about them. Maybe Rotten Tomatoes was wrong.
Maybe they're all fools, and you should watch these movies regardless. We'll also talk about scenes that could have saved it, and we'll often refer to Simone's cats because they're amazing and adorable, and we love them.
And at the end of each review, we will tell you whether we would watch this movie again, or in what circumstances we would recommend you watch this movie.
So, join us on July 9th for the first drop of our main episode, and then 2 days later for our drop of our minisodes.
And on Robots Radio Podcast Network. Come see us on July 9th. We love you so much already. Bye! Bye.